you're always doing the right thing. Because you have a steadiness about you. And I believe in you. But it comes soon. And you must be smarter than your enemy.
What are you trying to say?
The Americans, they're very smart, but sometimes they can be incredibly stupid. They spend all this money, time, and energy on the so-called war on terror. They put satellites up in space. They can ram a smart bomb up a camel's ass from a situation over 5,000 miles away. But every time the U.S. kills an Al-Qaeda leader, what happens? There's a new one before the body's cold. You do it a million times, and they never get it because the real solution always eludes them.
What is?
Do nothing.
Nothing.
Nada. If you want to shut down a fundamentally flawed system, all you gotta do is step out of its way, and it'll shut itself down. Nature has a way of correcting itself.
Hello, it is I, Digger Odell, the friendly undertaker. Oh, you don't remember that. You're too young to remember that. That was on the radio way back in the 40s and 50s. Yeah, I forgot what the name of the show was. I think it was The Great Gildersleeve. Yeah. Terrible Tommy here, White Aryan Resistance Radio. March the 19th. Boy, we're moving right along. And it's Thursday. Now, you should have your donations for the radio show in by now, because tomorrow's the 20th. We'd like to use that as a cutoff date on donations for the show. Yeah. And get your snail mail in there, and you'll be okay. That's right. And if you miss a show or something, you've got a question about what's going on there as far as back shows or anything like that, go email merchandiseresist@gmail.com, and the webmaster will fill you in and tell you what to do. You'll get it done quicker by doing that than going through me. Well, historically, I think we'll all agree, if we've been around a while and studied enough and dissected history and so forth, that World War I was a total idiotic mistake. And the United States, of course, should have never been into it at all. But the insanity of the First World War starting in Europe, led directly to the Second World War. If you didn't like the First World War, the Second World War was even worse. But there was really only one war. First World War never ended. They just took a little time off to build more weapons, and then they went back at it. I'm going to play an interview with an author of a new book, and I think you'll get quite a bit out of this. It's about a half an hour. And you'll be able to read between the lines of how insane for the white race to be warring against each other all the time. And all these basically white nations fighting each other. It may have destroyed the white race in the long run totally. Or we may recover. But we can't afford another one of those things, I'll tell you that. Here we go.
I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. The 20th century, the catastrophe of the Second World War. the mass murder and the damage to comedy that continues here in the 21st century. All of Europe, all of Asia, all of the powers, including China in its memory of the war with Japan, or Russia in its memory of the war with Germany and the United States, all of that is in the beginning a story of competing economies, competing nation states during the worst economic crisis modern times have ever seen. The Depression. John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. The 20th century, the catastrophe of the Second World War, the mass murder and the damage to comedy that continues here in the 21st century. All of Europe, all of Asia, all of the powers, including China in its memory of the war with Japan, or Russia in its memory of the war with Germany and the United States, all of that is in the beginning a story of competing economies, competing nation states during the worst economic crisis modern times have ever seen. The Depression, the crash of all the markets, 1929 and 1933. A new book, Cry Havoc, tells the story of the arms race in 1931 to 41 and how that arms race drove the world to war. In other words, it isn't guns, it's building the armaments, the ballistics, the munitions, the tanks, the airplanes, the fleets. That is what went to war in 1939 to 1945. How did they build it? Why? What did they think while they were competing with each other? Professor Joseph Maiolo, who teaches in London at King's College, has put all this together, this massive manuscript, corresponding conferences between all of these nations and all of these languages, long before they become to the crisis of Munich in 38, they have set their course on collision. Professor, congratulations and good evening, and I take you to an exciting moment for us spies. It is April of 1929, and MI6, the spies themselves, James Bond's grandfathers, come up with a document that they claim shows that the Germans, Hitler is not yet in power. This is still the Weimar. The Germans plan to have a rearmament done by 1941-42, is my note, and they'll have 63 divisions. Joseph, what the heck are they talking about? I thought the war was over in 1918. Good evening to you.
And thank you very much for having me, and good evening to you. Well, this is just it. The spies uncovered secret German documents, war plans, really nothing but paper plans that the German Army General Staff were drawing up to build exactly the sort of army that they had in the First World War. But the key factor here, and this is what the spies and their political masters debated in London, would there be the industry, the armaments factories to produce the guns, the tanks, the aircraft to back up an army that large? And and that was a debate that was raging everywhere. Would anybody have the factories, the raw materials, the foodstuffs to wage total war like all the powers did towards the end of the First World War?
Plunging into all the states as they looked at each other, and sometimes I felt that I was reading your book as if I was reading a real-life history of the game of Risk, in which all these nation-states push little colored counters against each other. What is the word autarky, and how does it apply to the thinking of 1929-1931?
Well, it was one of the buzzwords of the day. All the war planners, all the handbooks on how to wage future war basically began with the premise that if you were going to win, you had to be self-sufficient or autarkic in the key resources, so iron ore, oil, food. And you had to control the factories, have the factories to convert these raw materials into weapons, and of course also to have the population to either work in the factories, the mines, or to man the armaments. So autarky effectively meant that you controlled sufficient land and people and hardware and resources to wage total war.
Would it be accurate to say that they were thinking of themselves as a castle, as a fortress, each state with walls up, and we have to produce everything we need to compete with the other states from inside the walls? Is that how they thought of themselves?
Well, that's exactly how they thought of it. In fact, Mussolini talks about the epoch of nations behind walls, so that you, again, sort of, you can imagine sort of a medieval mentality, a siege mentality, where within your walls you control all the things you need both to survive and to, to stretch the metaphor, to defeat somebody else's castle. And I argue, for example, that you have to understand the Soviet Union's five-year plans in this respect. They were designed basically to turn the Soviet Union, which had controlled the people and the resources, but lacked the industry, into a gigantic fortress for waging total war.
Let's go right to Russia, because the professor moves through Russia, Japan, Italy, France, Britain, the United States, each of them, including the United States, with their fortress mentality, even before the crash, even before the failure of the banks, even before the worldwide depression. That is the conception for going to the next war, future war. And there was there were books written called Future War. In the Soviet Union, Stalin is all powerful because he's a backstabber and a cutthroat and ruthless. However, he does not acknowledge what they need until a man named Tukhachevsky becomes chief of staff. Who is Tukhachevsky, and what does he see?
He's a brilliant military theorist. He's a rising star in the Red Army. He becomes a top military planner, and he had a brilliant mind, really. But a mind that, the sort of brilliance that becomes a bit detached from reality. So he draws up war plans that call for fantastic numbers of tanks and airplanes and guns, and presents these to the chiefs of the Red Army staff and to Stalin directly. And Stalin initially dismisses these plans, and also those who are planning the economy, the first five-year plans, look at what Tukhachevsky's plans entail, and effectively he's saying that the military should control the entire economy. Now, saying that in the Soviet Union is effectively saying that you really want to have a military coup. So Stalin initially both dismisses Tukhachevsky from his post and scolds him, precisely for this reason, that he's crossing the line between what should lay in the military sphere into the political. But then in the early 1930s, the Japanese occupy Manchuria, and there's a war scare, and suddenly Tukhachevsky comes to the top again, precisely because he has the sort of bold vision to use the first five-year plan as a platform for creating the scale of the military industry that the Soviet Union needs to, for example, defeat Japan.
And what drives in scale is always steel. How much steel can we produce? When? All the competing steel, and we'll hear about that in Britain and Germany. But the professor mentions Japan and its attack on Manchuria. I learn of a colonel. In fact, I learn of a series of colonels. They all start out without generals' ranks, and they dream of a future conquest. In the Japanese Imperial Army, as they begin their expedition, their adventure into Manchuria, the conquest of parts of China, they converted into Manchukuo. Their names are Suzuki Taichi, Tojo Hideki, and most brilliant of all, Ishiwara Kanji. What did they see, Professor? Who were they?
These were, as you point out, fairly young officers who, during the First World War, Japan didn't directly participate in the First World War to the very end, and then only naval forces. But these Japanese officers look at what's happening in Europe, and they learn a vital lesson. Imperial Germany, the Imperial German Army, is a magnificent war machine operationally. It wins battles all over the place. But in a contest between modern economies, it's the biggest and most self-sufficient economies that are going to win. And, of course, Germany is defeated. And this comes as quite a shock to these Japanese officers, for a number of reasons, not the least of which is the Imperial Army, the Japanese Imperial Army, had always looked at Germany as its model. So these officers look towards Japan in the post-war period And they try and measure Japan's capability against all the other great powers. And, of course, Japan is this resource-poor island off the Asian mainland, and all the resources they need are on the mainland, and particularly in Manchuria. So by the time these men, you know, by the early 30s, are in positions of influence, you know, to make a very long story short, they concoct a conspiracy to launch a war to conquer Manchuria without actually the approval of the cabinet in Tokyo. But the war is so popular in Japan that the cabinet adopts it as its own. And the basic premise here is we need to conquer Manchuria, which is rich in, again, iron ore, foodstuffs, timber, all the things you need for a modern economy, and to convert this huge space the equivalent of the size of Germany and France put together, into a bastion, an economic, industrial bastion for waging total war against the Soviet Union. Because these officers are looking at this first Soviet five-year plan, and they're afraid. Because if the Soviets achieve what they want to achieve, they will have the capacity to overwhelm, to drown, basically, the Japanese army in armaments.
Note what the professor says. The Japanese look to the Russians to justify their drive into Manchuria, Manchukuo, their aggression. The Russians look to, for example, Germany and Britain as an explanation for why they must drive. These are all men building castles, and those castles will go to war. When we come back, we'll turn to the Italian castle. Well, it's a metaphor. Cry Havoc, How the Arms Race Drove the World to War, 1931 to 1941. Joseph Maiolo is the author. I'm John Batchelor. John Batchelor Show. I'm speaking to Professor Joseph Maiolo. His book is Cry Havoc, which is the story of the arms race that becomes the catastrophe of the Second War in 1939-1946. However, what we have now, and the Cold War follows immediately afterwards, so it never really ends until the fall of the Berlin Wall. What we have now is Italy, where Mussolini, a journalist, a publisher, a provocateur, comes to power very early compared to the rest of his colleagues. In 1922-23, but he sees or he envisions Italy also as an autarkic state. It must have everything it needs. He even goes looking for territory for its excess population, and he finds it in Ethiopia. Professor, did Mussolini have the industry to justify his building a castle out of Italy?
Oh, not at all. I mean, again, here we have an example, not unlike Japan, of a great power, of a very large and important power, that simply lacks both the industry and the resources within its own frontiers to be taken seriously as a power capable of waging total war. Now, one logical conclusion, and there were Italian military planners who came to this conclusion, well, rather than try and fight long, big wars, we should just create a very highly efficient, you know, mechanized army, you know, fast air force and superior navy that can win quick wars. But the planners who prevail in Italy, and the most important of whom, of course, is Mussolini himself, understand that to be a great power, to be one of the biggest powers in the world, you have to be a power that's capable of waging total war. And that means moving your frontiers, in a sense, you know, again, according to the metaphor, pushing your castle walls out to be able to control those resources. Now, of course, for Italy, you know, this peninsula jutting out into the Mediterranean, there are very few directions you can go. And one of the few places that isn't controlled by one of the other big imperial powers, France or Britain, is Ethiopia, an independent state, really, member of the League of Nations. And, well, Italy tries to conquer and indeed succeeds in conquering Ethiopia. But, of course, Ethiopia is a pretty poor conquest because it doesn't have the resources Italy needs. And it's, in fact, something of a waste of Italy's military and financial power to do so.
It does, however, trigger enmity with Britain, and that becomes part of the complication. All of these powers are looking at each other, but at the time, it's always possible that Italy could go to war with the United States, or Japan could go to war with the Soviet Union. There's no particular order. There's just gathering resources and building armaments. France, Viga is the man who works for Foch, the famous Generalissimo, of the field, and they believe that France, after the first war, is desperately weakened because they've lost a lot of manpower. They're also a much larger state than Germany in the beginning, but as we approach the Second World War, because of their losses in the First War, they're a much smaller state. Did they see themselves as an independent castle in the way that Germany or Japan does? Or did they see themselves in alliance as they rearmed?
Well, in fact, that's an excellent question, because France is really the exception of the rule that most states didn't actively seek alliances. Because the French, particularly the military planners, are acutely aware of their relative weakness if compared to Germany. And it's one of the reasons why, for example, they built the Maginot Line, this line of defenses, in order to absorb the initial German attacks and hopefully wear the Germans down. But no, the French planners were aware of their relative weakness and always assumed that if they were going to fight Germany and win, that they had to have Britain and hopefully the United States on side. They also formed alliances with Poland and Czechoslovakia in the 1920s and 30s, again, hoping that these small states would join them in a war against Germany and, in a sense, be cannon fodder in the initial stages of any war. France was reliant on overseas export and the manpower from its own empire and, their military planners assumed, manpower first from the British Empire and, again, eventually the United States.
The puzzle about the French is at no point did I think that they were free to arm because of their labor troubles. Is this the state that was more weakened by socialism than any other?
Yeah, well, that was, I mean, that's an excellent question, too, because that's precisely the perception of all the other powers, including the British, the Germans, and the Italians, that the social unrest, the industrial divide between employers and workers in Germany, in France, means that the French state just does not have the internal cohesion to wage total war. And, of course, the comparison always is France against, compare the social cohesion of France with that of Germany. And so there were a lot of, I'm trying to look for the right word, admirers of the German state or the regimentation of the German state in France, hoping to emulate the German system of creating an internal unity. Now, of course, the problem is, do you do that from the right or from the left? And this was precisely the dispute. Do you have popular front governments that are hoping to unite the country around a left-wing agenda, and you also have a right-wing hoping to create something like a fascist state. And, of course, after France is defeated in 1940 and the Vichy regime is formed, it's those thinkers who are trying to unite France from the right who come to power.
I'm speaking with Professor Joseph Maiolo. His book is Cry Havoc: How the Arms Race Drove the World to War. Remember, we started with the MI6 report, April 1929, saying the Germans have a plan for rearmament to 63 divisions. We best get ready. I mentioned that on November 1934, Winston Churchill, a rebel in the Tories, rose to protest about the illegal German rearmament because of the Versailles Treaty. And that begins the argument about what to do about Herr Hitler and his plans to rearm Germany. When we come back, Britain and Germany eyeing each other for peace and war. I'm John Batchelor. That's the show. Cry Havoc is the book. Professor Joseph Maiolo. This is the story of the arms race that drives the world to war, 1931 to 1941. And of course there's a lesson in here for all times, because arms races precede the battle. At any one point, if you can identify a race for weapon systems, each major state will seek that weapon system for itself. We have a battlefield right now that's suggestive that there's an arms race in cyber war. Well, at this time, it was a race in steel war. Professor, the British were watching the Germans after Hitler takes command in, Ludendorff. He's invited by the Chancellor to become, by the President to become Chancellor of Germany in the winter of 1933. He immediately begins a plan of converting Germany into a castle, a fortified, rearmed castle. The Versailles Treaty looks to restrict him on that, But it doesn't stop him. The British are aware of this, which is why Chamberlain rises to protest in November of 1934. Why didn't they stop him?
Well, we have to take the story just a bit earlier to 1932 and the failure of the World Disarmament Talks. The League of Nations convenes a conference that's supposed to establish worldwide levels of armaments and reduce the expense of world military armies and navies and air forces. When these talks stalled in 32, 33, and 34, and of course the Nazis come to power and walk out of these talks, British and indeed French political leaders and military planners thought what would happen is that Germany would arm, but arm to a certain level that meant that they could deter attack and stop there, because of course you wouldn't want to convert the entire economy over to munitions, because well then you would ruin your economy. This was the logic. And of course the planners and politicians in Britain assumed this, that somehow a natural balance would be established between the European powers, none unlike that prevailed before long before the First World War broke out. So in other words, everybody would mutually deter everyone else from arming. And of course, Hitler doesn't stop German rearmament, and everyone in London is looking towards Germany and saying, well, you know, when are they going to stop? We'll offer to negotiate, and then we'll also begin to rearm, because of course the British begin to rearm in 1934-35 and identify Germany as their ultimate potential enemy. And Churchill is talking about this in Parliament. And behind the scenes, Chamberlain, as Chancellor of the Exchequer, is one of the driving forces as the man with the money behind British rearmament. And he says, well, let's not build a big army like we did in the First World War. What we need is a powerful navy, and more important than that, a very powerful air force to deter Germany.
That's the Royal Air Force plan. If my note says Scheme A, July 18th, 1934. This is the confusion for me. Ramsay MacDonald is Labour. That's the left. And,
that's right.
And he has a national unity government
that's right.
Mostly the Conservatives. It's mostly the Tories, including
right.
Chamberlain. So are they as confused then as I am now as to which direction they were going?
You mean politically? Or,
yes, politically.
Or,
politically,
or
I couldn't tell.
Policy,
any particular
yes.
day, it was peace, war, armament, gesture, industry, guns, butter. They were going back and forth for 5 years.
That's right. I mean, and behind the scenes, there is a lot of confusion about, you know, industrial policy, foreign policy, rearmament, and but the one overriding aim, of course, is to avoid a war and to recover from the depression itself, because Britain has suffered as a consequence of the economic crash.
And you make a point that when the armament chiefs, the men who drive the armament of all these nations, when they collide with the worldwide depression, instead of decelerating their wishes to build autarkic states, it accelerates it. In fact, it moves the state into a national military state faster than would have been true if there had been times of prosperity.
That's precisely correct, because it was assumed that what happened was the economic crash confirmed that if you leave economies to market forces, inevitably you're going to get a big crash. If you get a big crash, that disrupts industry, it puts people out of work, and you may in fact have revolution on your hands very quickly. So the military and economic planners agree about one thing, that you need a powerful state to control the economy and to suppress markets. And you need that in peacetime to avoid economic downturns, and you need that in wartime to maximize resources to win victory. And here, this is where the competition between Britain and Germany turns. It looks like, from London's point of view, that the Germans are going all out to create a wartime economy. That leaves Britain with two choices. It can follow suit, it can emulate that, but then that has political consequences. You turn a liberal democracy into a dictatorship, effectively. or you do something to deter the Germans, to persuade them that, you know, to stop rearming. And the solution that everyone arrives at is you build a big enough air force to scare the Germans into negotiating. And that policy, you know, becomes known as appeasement.
The Germans, Hitler driving this, of course. I am stunned to learn again and again with Hitler that he said what he wanted to do right away. There were never any secrets. He wanted Lebensraum, which would lead to the mass murder between Germany and Russia in 1939 to 1945. He also said that he wanted to attack, that he wanted a war, the ability to wage war quickly. He said it right away to all of the commanders, and he said it in 1933, and they sort of believed him because it suited them. Who is Blomberg, and what was his role in converting Germany into a national military state?
Well, he's a war minister. He's appointed by Hindenburg, in a sense, to be the caretaker of the military under this strange new regime that's going to be run by these Nazis, who, you know, the conservative elite in Germany tended to view as basically barbarians. But Blomberg is sympathetic to Hitler and the Nazi aims of regimenting the entire state,
right,
everybody and the economy. Because he understands from the point of view of winning a future war that you need that kind of political system to win it. Now, of course, what he means, or what he intends, when he forms this early alliance with Hitler to both rearm Germany and to keep the army out of politics, because the army is the one institution in Germany that could sweep away the Nazis overnight. The deal he thinks he makes is that the armed forces, him and, you know, Blomberg himself, will control the economy, or that through some proxy, some economic dictator, that the army will control the economy.
He has allies initially, Georg,
right,
Thomas and Schock, the head of the Reichsbank.
That's right.
The Reichsminister who has the money.
That's right.
And those three resist a long time this Nazi urge towards provocation. But at the same time, they're building up the military. Do they build it up equally, Army, Kriegsmarine, and Luftwaffe, or do they lean towards the Army?
Well, the army is winning the full share of steel and certainly the Air Force. The Navy initially is limited simply because, I mean, you know, big battleships, aircraft carriers, destroyers, all of these massive warships are made of steel. You need a lot of steel. You need a lot of skilled labor. You need a lot of machine tools, plant to be able to produce them. So Hitler makes a political gesture, a ploy really, towards London, and says, well, we're going to limit the size of our Navy to 35%. And there's this famous deal in June of 1935, the Anglo-German Naval Agreement, where the Germans say, well, we're going to build a small Navy. And the premise of this is that in the last war, before the last war, we provoked the British by building a huge fleet. We won't do that this time. And Hitler thought when he did this that he'd bought the British off. Of course, the British don't leave him alone and, you know, worry about their empire and their sea power. They're interested in the continent, because the British can never allow Hitler or Germany in general, under whatever regime, to control the whole of the European continent.
Seizing on that moment, Professor, 1935, the London Naval Conference, at that point, it reads as if Hitler's entertaining the possibility that he can in some way form an alliance with London against Russia. Is that a fair reading of 1935? He still hasn't settled that the British will be the enemy.
Well, if his plan really is to neutralize Britain, neutralize France, and at least bring, if he needs an ally, it's going to be Italy, and the first enemy is going to be Russia. And he plans a war against Russia for the early 1940s. The deal he thinks he's made with the British, who he assumes are anti-Bolshevik and aiming at perhaps waging some sort of joint war against the Soviets in the future, the deal he cuts he thinks he's cut in 1935 is one on spheres of influence. We'll leave you alone at sea. You know, if you need our Navy to fight the Americans, we'll give it to you. You know, worry about your empire. We'll worry at sea, and we'll worry about our land empire, Central and Eastern Europe. And of course, you know, this is madness. The British have no intention of accepting such a deal.
But it is a fascination to me to go through your book, Professor, and find that at any given time in each of these capitals, Tokyo, Moscow, Berlin, Paris, London, even Washington, they could imagine another set of enemies or another set of allies. Enemy of my enemy is my friend. There was no set in stone way to regard the Axis and the Allied powers that we eventually got. Those were a product of the momentary decision.
Well, that's right. It follows the logic of and to follow your metaphor of castles. If you're waging wars between empires behind walls and seeking self-sufficiency, well, then you don't really need nor want the trouble of an ally.
The book is Cry Havoc, How the Arms Race Drove the World to War, 1931 to 1941. The scene is set for the catastrophe of the war in Europe and Asia that will come. When we come back, what about the Americans? What about the American castle? Franklin Delano Roosevelt, did he build one? Was it self-conscious? I'm John Batchelor. This is Batchelor Show. It's guns, it's never butter. And when they're building guns and they're short of butter, what do? They build more guns. That's the lesson of Cry Havoc, How the Arms Race Drove the World to War, 1931 to 1941. That is not my speech, that's Joseph Goebbels. We don't need butter, we just want guns, and we want steel. And there's never enough steel for Goering and his Luftwaffe. But back in the United States, there is a striking moment, Professor, when MacArthur is conferring with the new president, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And he says to the president, and there's a quote here, and you have a footnote, and it's connected to MacArthur's memoir. So it sounds like MacArthur's telling this, not FDR. He says to the president, "You're not giving me enough for the army. You're not building enough. You're cutting too deeply." And the quote is astonishing. MacArthur, General of the Army MacArthur, to the president of the United States, "An American boy lying in the mud with an enemy bayonet through the belly, and an enemy foot on his dying throat, and he will curse the name Roosevelt." MacArthur said that to the President of the United States. How did Roosevelt respond? I know he threw him out of the White House, but did Roosevelt then begin to think about building enough for a future war?
We only have MacArthur's memoirs as evidence of this, so it's not entirely clear the full story. But it's a great vignette because it highlights why is MacArthur making this case? Because the U.S. Army planners want precisely the same sort of plans in place to convert U.S. industry, you know, the Ford motor industry. Into the sort of mass war machine that the planners in Europe and in Asia are looking to do with their own economies. And of course, the irony here is abroad, everybody assumed that the Americans had done precisely that. But a lot of the U.S. Army plans, mobilization plans for the economy, by the way, the initial ones were actually drawn up by Eisenhower as a young major.
Right. That's when Marshall called him out of Texas and told him to write a plan. It's a wonderful moment as well.
It's great, yes.
You can't make this stuff up. You really can't.
I think they nicknamed him a Dictator Dwight, actually,
yes,
because
right.
These plans left one big question mark. Who, you know, once you've sort of mobilized all of U.S. industry and natural resources and people to wage a total war, who politically controls this? Again, because this kind of scale of mobilization seems precisely compatible with democracy itself. So who controls it? And that question is never answered, of course, until the approach to war begins. And it becomes something of a dispute within the White House. Now, in a lot of ways, the Great Depression also places a question mark beside who controls the economy and who should control the economy and what role should the state have in the economy. And Roosevelt's answer to that, of course, is the New Deal and the expansion of the state's role and the huge investment in the economy to get it going. And as historians, I mean, I'm not the first to point this out. As historians have pointed out before, this becomes something of the New Deal and the intervention in the economy becomes something of a dry run for what the American economy will go through in 1940-41 and then into the war. But Roosevelt's answer to that question that Eisenhower, you know, back in the 1920s asked, who controls the economy, the U.S. economy in wartime? His answer is, well, the President of the United States. And that answer, of course, is what causes tension between him and his military planners.
Germany knew as early as 1937, Hitler knew, that he couldn't win a war against Britain and France if they had time to respond with their industries. He certainly knew that there was an inclination by Roosevelt to come in on the side of the British. That's what had happened in the first war. And he knew that if America gets in, there's no way to win any war whatsoever because the natural resources and the manpower will overwhelm us. And even if we can slow them down, and that's what the wolf pack was all about in the North Atlantic. Hitler knew all that, and yet still he launched the preemptive war in 1939. Was the presumption on his part that the war had to be 6 weeks or we lose, 6 months or we lose? Did he have a clock in his head?
He certainly did. I mean, that four-hour harangue you referred to in November 1935, the one theme...
1937, November 37.
November 37, yes. That's right, Hossbach conference. The one theme that ties that whole speech together is time. And Hitler is feeling time, the weight of time, as everyone else is beginning to rearm. And he knows that once everybody's reached a certain level of armaments, introducing another metaphor, his window of opportunity to be successful is shrinking all the time. So he's looking for some way to engineer a quick series of wars that might bring victory, or at least put him into a position where he controls enough resources and people and financial resources to win. And the war he planned originally to wage in the mid-1940s against the Soviet Union to create a vast German empire actually becomes a war against Britain and France in 1939, precisely because Hitler feels he's running out of time and he has to eliminate Poland as a potential enemy, cut some sort of deal with the Soviet Union, and defeat France and at least knock Britain out of Europe as a power.
And the alliance with the Japanese is to weaken the British so that they are not able to mount their resources against him.
That's exactly right. Hitler looks at both the Japanese Navy and even the Italian Navy as ways of threatening Britain before 1940-41, and then once after France falls in the summer of 1940 war with the United States looms on the horizon, he hopes to use the Japanese fleet as a threat against the United States so they stay out of Europe.
Cry Havoc is the book, How the Arms Race Drove the World to War 1931 to 1941. Professor Joseph Maiolo is the author. It will challenge your assumptions about good guys and bad guys, about how the world came together into this mess we have in the 21st century. Armaments, industry, especially steel, drove the decisions that led to that catastrophe, 1939 and 1946. I'm John Batchelor.
Well, there you go. The whole ball of wax, as Ben Klassen would say. And that, I think, is a bright new perspective on what built up to World War II and even part of World War I, of which now you can see that all these countries are thinking about war almost all the time and thinking in a way that we better get ready because that guy over there is going to do something. Now, this is all the paranoia that exists in the ruling class and the military-industrial complex. So you can see there that it wasn't all Hitler. I think he lit the fuse, but everybody was into the act. And now how would that apply today? Since the same thing is going on, Will a country like China lay back and watch America, United States, deplete its materials and so forth and become the empire weaken, and then it will be their day militarily? The other question is this. Now, what are we going to do or what would the system do in this country for massive amounts of materials it would take to fight a real third world war? And you look it around, you say the manufacturing is gone. Yeah, the manufacturing is almost all gone. Heavy materials and manufacturing and everything like that is gone. So that leads you to the obvious conclusion that the only way that the military-industrial complex of the United States could involve themselves into a war either aggressively or defensively is the use of atomic weapons in a blitzkrieg type situation. And that's the only way they could do it. They got the powerful air force, and that's the main thing when you're talking about nukes. But they would have to resort to nukes because they could not build up enough reserves in the industrial might to carry out a war like World War II. So if there's going to be a war down the line, a big war, the first one out of the chute with the nukes is supposed to be the so-called winner. That's why we can't have any allegiance to these leaders in these countries, because the people, if they were to vote on it, most people, not all people, because there are a lot of war lovers out there. Most people would say, no, we don't want to go to war. You know, things aren't that bad here. But, of course, the general population of any country does not have say at all. They can scream democracy all they want, but it doesn't exist. It's all run by oligarchies and the powerful and the ruling class, and they can bullshit you, the public, along, but the public is not going to have any say, and the only say they could have is revolution and civil war. And then, of course, the system would use the might of its military and air force and everything else against the people. They don't trust the people anyhow. And especially with a mixed race bunch of people we got in this country now, that could not reach a consensus on anything, but could naturally come to the point of civil war for food and for all kinds of housing and all that kind of stuff, which is very possible. So how that would enter into the plans and the ideas of the central state as far as any foreign enemy like Russia or anything like that, so-called enemy, I guess we'll just have to wait and see. Anyhow, I hope you enjoy that. But it gives you something to think about, which much of the history of these wars is not really covered in a nonsensical, truthful way. And this man wrote a book. He didn't really have an axe to grind with anybody of the way it was and the stupid things that people did. Now, see, Hitler knew he couldn't win against the United States because of the vast material production. And he knew he had to do this real quick. Well, he didn't make it, and he should have backed off. He should have cut his losses and sued for peace even before Barbarossa and the invasion of Russia. And he could have salvaged the German country and the German people and himself, because up until even Barbarossa, even after they'd taken Poland, Hitler could have been gone down in history as just another famous and respected with many statesmen. But he didn't do it. And look at all those millions of German white men that died in the East so much more than the West. And this is how little regard these leaders, Churchill too, all these guys, have for the bulk of the race. They don't care. They'll fight to the death of everybody else but themselves. And so there was nobody that could win in World War I or World War II. There is no winning as far as the race is concerned. And so the only way out is to resist any kind of that kind of activity. And that means you got to move to the left, so to speak, the left. You got to resist and speak out against occupations and so forth. Instead of like the right wing, Fox TV up there and people like that are saying, kill them, kill them, kill them all, kill them all, kill them all. This is a kind of fanaticism that gets people in big trouble. And of course the people are always yelling, kill them, kill them, kill them, are never the ones who are going to do the fighting and dying. So anyhow, tell me what you think. Well, I see the Attorney General and the FBI and all of them got what they wanted. Another false flag operation where the skinheads got in a rumble over drugs, I'm sure. And several were killed and arrested. And they'll make that'll be the great biggest news for weeks and weeks. And showing all their pictures with the tattoos all over their faces and all that kind of stuff. And that will relieve them from worrying about the crimes of the government people themselves and the droning and the occupation murders in the Middle East. And so they need that kind of stuff. So they need, whether it's the skinheads or who it is, to do things like this that draws the attention away from the big picture. Of course, the concept of the skinheads was simply a foot in the door for white youth, white working class youth, to come together and act as a resistance to the crimes and political persecution of the white working people. And that's what I promoted all the time. But by the 80s, mid-80s, a little after that, maybe towards the 90s, I could see that was not going to happen. Because there were people out there in the right wing that were turning these guys more into thugs than Aryan soldiers and political soldiers and so forth. Whereas I was advocating to get out of being traditional skinheads and let their hair grow out, dress normally, go to college, university, and do your best to get into the corporations and the military and the police and wherever you could get into where there was power. And there's a percentage of them did. And I'm glad they're there. I know they're there, but they're never to talk to me or communicate with me at all, nor should they with anybody else. That's why lone wolf is so important. But anyhow, this is the leaders of the right wing, beginning, they didn't want to have anything to do with the skinheads. And I and a couple of others were the only ones that wanted to have anything to do with the skinheads, because where are you going to get white youth from if not the skinheads? And I was condemned all over the place by the right wing. Then when the right wing figured out that they could pick up the skinheads and use them, not only to, you know, hawk their music and make a lot of money on their music, but get them involved in other activities that had very little to do with what my ideas were all about. And so that's what led to so many of them ending up in prison. They weren't listening to me anymore, and they were listening to the old right wing, that they don't care what happens, get people in trouble. They go to prison, they just write them off. I mean, you know, they don't write them or support them or send them any money or anything else once they've... And then they keep them in the idea of just going out on the streets and beating up people and things like that, which was not the proposal at all in the beginning. they were to be perfectly defensive and to protect other leaders who were speaking and things like that, and rallies and things like that. They weren't created to go out and be thugs. But that's what we've got here with skinheads teaming up with the Aryan Brotherhood. And people like that, and they're off into drugs and trying to be mini cartels. There's nothing we can do about, nothing I can do about it anymore. They're out there and they're going to do what they're going to do. But they were told the right way in the beginning, but they just didn't tend to follow it. I think, as I've said for several years, that the new blood is going to come from the left. Not necessarily the beginning a lot of it, but I think that as time goes on in this country, you're going to see a lot of new blood come in and not go across into the right wing, because they're not going to go the right wing any more than I am. But I don't think it's too much of a switch to bring people that are against war, they're against predatory capitalism, they're for the environment, anti-war, anti-corporation, and all that kind of stuff of the left, which I agree with in most cases, but attach the survival and best interests of the white race as racial separatists, you know, not as capitalist conquerors that we want to invade and conquer countries, and we have to have a position of supporting other people's separate ideas, whether the non-white or not, and not to be into the right-wing mode of conquering everybody and every nation and making them slaves or whatever. So anyhow, that's it for today. I'll be back tomorrow on Thursday, and you analyze what I've said today, and I'd appreciate your comment. Okay, 14-5 and shut up. I have nothing to say.
But you have no right to call me a murderer. You have a right to kill me. You have a right to do that. But you have no right to judge me. It's impossible through words to describe what is necessary to those who do not know what horror means. Horror. Horror has a face, and you must make a friend of horror. Horror and moral terror are your friends. If they are not, then they are enemies to be feared. They are truly enemies. I remember when I was with Special Forces. Seems 1,000 centuries ago. We went into a camp to inoculate some children. We left the camp after we had inoculated the children for polio. And this old man came running after us, and he was crying. He couldn't see. We went back there, and they had come and hacked off every inoculated arm. There they were in a pile. A pile of little arms. And I remember I cried, I wept like some grandmother. I wanted to tear my teeth out. I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I want to remember it. I never want to forget it. I never want to forget. And then I realized, like I was shot with a diamond. A diamond bullet right through my forehead. And I thought, my God, the genius of that. The genius, the will to do that. Perfect, genuine, complete, crystalline, pure. And then I realized they were stronger than me because they could stand up. These were not monsters. These were men, trained cadres. These men who fought with their hearts, who have families, who have children, who are filled with love. But they had the strength to do that. If I had 10 divisions of those men, then our troubles here would be over very quickly. You have to have men who are moral and at the same time who are able to utilize their primordial instincts to kill without feeling, without passion, without judgment. Because it's judgment that defeats us.